Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Imagine, if you would, for a moment, April of 1865. Richmond fell on Sunday, April 2nd, 1865. On April 4, President Lincoln was in Richmond with his 12-year-old son. Thousands of overjoyed African Americans encircled and followed him, our guest writes in her lovely new book, important new book. Celebrations were taking place in many communities in the North, but in the South, there was great distress. On April 11, President Lincoln stood on the White House balcony and spoke of Reconstruction, which he said would be fraught with great difficulty. John Wilkes Booth was listening to Lincoln's remarks. On April 14, President Abraham Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater, and he died April 15th. This hour, on the 150th anniversary of the shot that soon ended his life, the author of Mourning Lincoln, which begins with the fall of the Confederate capital and the surrender of General Robert E. Lee, and continues through the execution of four of the conspirators in early July, and also looks at the post-war decades. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest, this author. She is Martha Hodes. Martha is a professor of history at New York University, author also of The Sea Captain's Wife, A True Story of Love, Race, and War in the 19th Century, and White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century South. Martha, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for writing this book. It was very moving. It's a very moving book.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's wonderful to be here.
And you read something like 1,000 diaries, and you read all kinds of letters that were written by people like us, you know, on those days during the months right after the assassination. But you centered on really three people, which must have been hard to do considering all of the letters, really staunch Unionists and a really complete Confederate, you know, so that their views of what happened here. I tend to look at things from the Union side, and for the first time you really opened my eyes, I think, to people who felt completely differently about what happened today 150 years ago.
Yes, that's right. So the book, for the book, I read hundreds and hundreds of letters and diaries, and I quote them all throughout the book from all different sides, so black and white, Union, Confederate, men and women, soldiers and civilians. But through the story, I follow three characters, just as you said. One of them is a couple, Sarah and Albert Brown, and they are devoted abolitionists from Massachusetts, and they are devastated by Lincoln's assassination. And then in counterpoint to Sarah and Albert Brown, I have Rodney Dorman, who you described well. He is a diehard rebel. He despises Lincoln. He is absolutely infuriated by the defeat of the Confederacy at the end of the Civil War. And I chose those characters because they were two ends of the political spectrum. They mm-hmm. gave such a vivid portrait of the animosity between the two sides, even at the end of the war.
What was extraordinary is for me to think of the entire month, and you really take us from the fall of Richmond and the surrender, the Confederate surrender, and all of these celebrations, which you must have read a lot of letters for, what was happening with bonfires in Chicago and people having celebrations and drinking in places all over the country, and to think about what was going to happen just two weeks thereafter. But also, as I started the show, with Lincoln giving his thoughts from the balcony about how hard Reconstruction was going to be, it was just, what a month to live through. Can you imagine living through that month in this country?
Well, exactly. And what's so fascinating is that people wrote about that in their diaries and letters.
Yes.
They would say things like, 500 years of history has passed in this one month, or I feel I have lived a century of history. And so they really felt connected to the history going on around them. They knew they were participants, as terrible as it was that Lincoln had been assassinated. One man wrote to his son, "You will be glad that you were alive at this time." It was momentous. It was world history.
Yes, it was. Let's talk about African Americans for a moment. You write early in the book about the thousands of overjoyed African Americans who formed circles around Abraham Lincoln and his son Ted on April 4 when he was in Richmond, and then go ahead to the thousands of African Americans who were outside the White House gates after he had been shot.
Absolutely. So for African Americans, and interestingly, white mourners conceded this, the loss of Lincoln was even worse than it was for white Americans. So one former slave used this phrase. She said, "It was an electric shock to my soul." African Americans said things like, "I would rather have died myself. I feel as my mother and father had died at the same time." Black soldiers in the Union Army were, and this is a quotation from a soldier, overcome with tears. Free African Americans in the North wrote that they felt their hopes were lost, their hopes were stricken down. Frederick Douglass called it an unspeakable calamity. African Americans had been critical of Lincoln during the war because he had been slow to act on emancipation, and he had learned a great deal from African American activists and people like Frederick Douglass. And by the time he was assassinated, he had in many ways really come around, and people associated him with the Emancipation Proclamation and with black freedom.
Mm-hmm. And even Sarah Brown, who listened to the speech on April 11, thought that he was a little bit too conservative. She was a little upset with him, right? Even though she was an abolitionist.
That's a great example. During that speech on April 11th, Lincoln made what was really quite a moderate suggestion. He said, "I would myself prefer," and his preference was that the vote be extended to black men who had served in the Union Army and who he said were, quote, very intelligent. Hard to know what he meant by that.
Right.
And so, although that infuriated John Wilkes Booth, who, as you mentioned, was in the crowd that evening, Sarah Brown wrote in her diary, "Why can't he cut down the whole tree instead of just lopping off the branches?"
Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that as a historian?
She was representing the political persuasion of people who wanted Lincoln to move more quickly, who did not like the fact that he just said, "Well, it's my preference that black men have the vote." She wanted to hear, along with many African Americans, most all African Americans, wanted to hear Lincoln say, "Black men should have the vote." The thing about Lincoln is he was the consummate diplomat and statesman, and he rarely made statements that would shock anybody, and so he came across as very mild and very lenient and moderate, but that wasn't necessarily the case. It was the way he presented himself. And African-American activists, by the way, knew this, and they knew that it was their job, as it's the job of any activist, to push him, and that he would then slowly move over.
Mm-hmm. And what about Frederick Douglass is also such an incredibly fascinating person from this era. He had met at the assassination. He had only met with Lincoln three times. Is that what you write?
That is correct.
And tell me more about his statements following the assassination. What were his worries about the period to follow?
Well, Douglass is such a wonderful historical actor to follow through these events because he spoke so well what so many other people were thinking. When Lincoln was first assassinated and Douglass got the news, you know, we don't have personal papers. I didn't have access to personal papers of Frederick Douglass, but he has many, many speeches that he gave. And he gave an impromptu speech in Rochester, New York, where he was living. And in that, he said that he was personally aggrieved by the fact that Lincoln was assassinated. So Douglass understood that had Lincoln lived, he would have listened to African Americans, listened to the fact that they wanted not just freedom, but equality and citizenship and voting rights and land and education. And that, of course, was something that Lincoln's successor, President Andrew Johnson, did not do. In other words, he did not listen to African Americans when he took over the presidency. So Douglass was deeply, deeply devastated and disturbed, knowing what kind of an executive Lincoln would have been had he lived.
Mm-hmm. You tend to think, and maybe it's just we had to have this kind of idea about what happened to get through the horror of this time, but you write about people in the North, that there were a fairly large minority of Copperheads, they were called, who really were not Union sympathizers, who probably on April 15th, or as soon as they heard the news, kind of closed their doors and windows and kept quiet.
Well, that's right. So the Copperheads, they were named after a poisonous snake by their enemies, but they soon appropriated that name for themselves. They were Lincoln's northern enemies, the members of the Northern Democratic Party. And many of them did respond with glee to Lincoln's assassination. They hated Lincoln. They supported a war for the Union, but they did not support a war against slavery. And they considered Lincoln a tyrant, and many of the Union soldiers who had been conscripted, so some of those men were Copperheads as well. So that meant there were also Union soldiers who were pleased with Lincoln's assassination. Some stayed behind closed doors and didn't say a word, but not all. And I do have personal writings, letters and diaries, in which people recount some of the things they heard these people saying. So, for example, a woman listened as her Irish immigrant servants were, as she wrote, laughing all day. They were so glad Lincoln was dead, she said. What she went on to say was, they hate him for emancipating the Negroes, fearing we shall employ them. So you can see partly what's going on there. Right. There were Union soldiers who applauded or laughed or clapped or cheered, infuriating their Union comrades who were in mourning.
And let's go to Jacksonville, Florida, with another of the people that you highlight in your book, Rodney, who's pretty overjoyed at the assassination.
Yeah, Rodney Dorman was really such an interesting historical actor. He kept a voluminous diary in private. So these were his private thoughts. He was living in the Union-occupied city of Jacksonville. And he was overjoyed, as you say, that Lincoln was assassinated. He thought Lincoln was a monster and a tyrant. And the only thing better than assassination would have been public execution. That's what he wrote in his diary. So we really get a sense in his diary of the private thoughts of a diehard rebel, somebody who had no intention of giving up despite Confederate defeat.
Mm-hmm. And go to Fort Sumter for a moment. Sarah's husband, Albert, is getting the news a few days. She doesn't write to him until a few days after because she doesn't want to break the news to him. He is in Fort Sumter, or close to Fort Sumter, isn't he? There's just so much to take in from all that's going on, the ceremony that's taking place and the flag that's going up. Once again, it must have been an incredibly moving spirit, who they're listening to, and what's going on around them as well. What a place to be at that time in April.
Exactly. So Albert Brown, who was down south working for the Union Army during the war, and that's why there are so many letters between him and his wife, Sarah, he is at Fort Sumter during the celebration of Union victory, where the original flag that was lowered when the Confederates took Fort Sumter on April 12th, 1861, that original flag is being raised, re-raised over Fort Sumter. It's an enormous celebration. Henry Ward Beecher is there, the famous Northern minister, William Lloyd Garrison, the famous abolitionist, all kinds of African-American dignitaries, former slaves, senators, congressmen. People are celebrating this moment. Albert is there. And then a few days later, he gets the news. And then he also gets a letter from Sarah, who had gotten the news instantly because it had come over the telegraph. And the telegraph ran to her town, Salem, Massachusetts.
You know, it's interesting. I guess I didn't realize we tend to think that people have always received their news very fast. For us, it's, you know, the instant it happens. But in that time, people were getting, if you were in China, you didn't get the news until June.
That's right. That's exactly right. I actually found it fascinating how quickly people got the news
really?
In the 19th century. Well, the telegraph was instantaneous, or not like Twitter, but it was their Twitter. So on April 15th at 7:22 a.m., Lincoln died, and then the telegrams had already gone out about the assassination or the shooting, but then the telegrams went out saying that he had died. And that day, San Francisco got the news. Somebody stood on the steps of the telegraph office in San Francisco and read the telegram. And that was true in many, many places up and down the northern eastern seaboard, anywhere the telegraph lines ran. Now, the South had been ravaged during the war, and many of the telegraph lines had been cut. So New Orleans had to wait, maybe 4 or 5 days. And then, of course, overseas, there was no telegraph overseas in 1865. So about 2 weeks to get to London. And then, as you were saying, certain places didn't hear. China and Australia didn't hear until June.
And there were people, of course, who just simply didn't want to believe this. They said, well, this is just a rumor, right? A lot of people adhered to that for some time before they got definitive proof. This can't be.
Yes, that's exactly right. It was literally unbelievable, literally incredible. So people wrote in their journals and in their letters that they were astounded. They were stupefied. People wrote that it was like a thunderclap from a clear blue sky. So that's a wonderful metaphor of shock. People wrote it was a dream, a lie, a joke, a hoax. People said it was like watching a play on a stage. So, of course, today we would say, I felt like I was in a movie.
Mm-hmm. And yet there had to have been worries in many of them. He had to have received all kinds of death threats. And you talk about this white woman who worked at the Bureau of Indian Affairs who was afraid that he was going to get killed when he was in Richmond. And she says, and you quote her, "We thought Lincoln was risking too much to go to Richmond. He could get killed by some of those defeated arch rebels."
Yes. And in fact, there had been rumors or word of an assassination attempt when Lincoln had traveled from Illinois to Washington, D.C. for his first inauguration.
Yes.
And so people were aware of that. People were also aware of the fact that Lincoln was pretty cavalier about his comings and goings, and people frequently warned him that he should have more of a bodyguard presence. But he would generally say things like, you know, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. He did have a bodyguard who was supposed to be outside of his box at Ford's Theater that night, but when John Wilkes Booth came through, the bodyguard wasn't there.
Where was the bodyguard?
Well, the bodyguard seemed to have been absent or having a drink at a bar somewhere.
Huh.
But it's also important to remember that John Wilkes Booth was a well-known Shakespearean actor who knew his way around Ford's Theater, and the people at Ford's knew Booth.
Right.
So they didn't think anything of him walking through the theater, and he had actually come in earlier, the day or two before, to set up certain things in the box, like to bore a peephole so he could look through and see where Lincoln was sitting, to create a wedge so the door couldn't be opened after him. So his presence was not suspicious in Ford's Theater.
Mm-hmm. It is, you ask these questions at various points in the book, which are so profound, that Sarah and Albert started asking, how would the nation be reconstructed now? How would Andrew Johnson contend with the Confederates? What would become of the Emancipation Proclamation? Would black suffrage come to pass? There must have been so many people who just felt that those questions were very much up in the air.
Absolutely. People really had no idea what was going to happen next. Of course, everybody had ideas about Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, but people had ideas that were not always borne out. So, interestingly enough, Lincoln's white mourners thought of Andrew Johnson as someone who would be harsher with the former Confederates. And they thought that because Johnson had grown up in Tennessee with poor white family, and he did not like the Southern aristocracy, the slaveholders. African Americans, on the other hand, were well aware that although Johnson did not like Southern slaveholders, he also did not like black people, and he was more of a racist than he was anti-slaveholder. So they understood quite quickly that Johnson was not going to be their friend, and that was very distressing to them. And all of the questions that you mentioned all stemmed from what was the leader of the nation going to do now?
Mm-hmm. And what about Lincoln's comments on April 11, the White House balcony? Those comments were fairly brief, weren't they, on Reconstruction?
Yes. I mean, what's interesting about that speech is that people gathered thinking that he would make a victory speech because it was 2 days after Lee's surrender.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, Lincoln, being Lincoln, did something quite sober, quite moderate. He went through various scenarios for Reconstruction. It was all quite up in the air. He mentioned possibilities, you know, hence irritating abolitionists like Sarah Brown. But people often took that as what he would do if he had lived, and we really have no way of knowing. In some ways, they were suggestions or possibilities. But, for example, Frederick Douglass and African Americans took those words and, in a way, invoked them to their own effect by saying Lincoln would have made black suffrage happen, which isn't exactly what he said that night.
You sure do wish they had his mind taken care of Reconstruction, though, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
You don't want to play that game, and yet in this instance, you just have to ask how different it may have been.
Yes, and I think it's fair to say that Johnson was extremely dismissive. Andrew Johnson was extremely dismissive of African Americans. They sent petitions to him in the White House. They came to see him. They said things like, please think about what your noble predecessor would have done. And the things he wrote back to his African American petitioners were shameful. I mean, he told them to go to Africa. He told them they were loafers. He told them they couldn't have nobody can have everything they want. I mean, he really was very, very rude and dismissive to them. And so we know that Lincoln would not have responded in that way, although we don't know what he would have done.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls on this day, April 14, 150 years ago, at about 10:15 at night. President Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States, was shot by John Wilkes Booth, you know the story, at Ford's Theater, and he died at 7:22 the next morning. It was Good Friday when the shots rang out. And Martha Hodes has written a really compelling book. Mourning Lincoln is the name of Martha Hodes' book, and she has collected writings, diaries, and letters from regular people and important people on how they responded to all that was going on in the country, and there was so much in April of 1965, and that's what we're talking about this hour, how the news was passed on, how people didn't want to believe it, how African Americans' disbelief was most intense, she writes. She writes about how the country mourned, and she writes about what people thought of those who not only murdered Lincoln, but the other attempts on lives of Seward and others, and the trial and how that was followed. It's all part of her very moving book. But what's most moving are just the reminiscences of people. Those of us who have lived for a while have memories of 9/11 or of the John Kennedy assassination or Bobby's or Martin Luther King's, that we all had collective kind of mourning. But in this case, it wasn't a collective kind of mourning because some were cheering that he had died. What a time in American history. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where you're ever so welcome to leave your thoughts, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Martha Hodes. She is the author of Mourning Lincoln, and we're welcoming phone calls for her. 800-486-8655 is our number. Rich in Rhinelander, our first caller. Hi, Rich.
Thank you so much for this program.
You're welcome.
I told the screener that I feel like I've been in one too many movies in terms of assassinations. I remember exactly what I was wearing in November 1963, and then again, April 4th, 1968, but on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, I would just, since April is National Poetry Month, I wanted to know the author's response to my idea that right alongside this book, her book, which sounds like it's a disturbing book in the best sense of the word, that people should have Walt Whitman's When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed.
Hmm.
T.S. Eliot said April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead, mixing memory and desire. And this program is bringing back to me a lot of memories of assassinations in American culture,
right.
I guess. So I'll leave it at that, but I really appreciate the program. And, Kathleen, the trip to Gettysburg and Washington, D.C. in the spring, the year that you took us there on that bus trip,
yes,
is one of the best memories I have of any kind of trip.
Thank you, Rich.
You for that as well.
I feel exactly the same way. It was an extraordinary trip. And you were moved, I think, to write the book because of September 11, and you have memories, you were very young, of the Kennedy assassination as well, don't you, Martha?
Yes, that's exactly right. I do first want to thank the caller for the wonderful Walt Whitman reference, and
yes,
I do write about Whitman in the book. He did write two wonderful, beautiful poems about Lincoln very shortly after the assassination, When Lilacs Last and The Dooryard Bloomed, and also O Captain, My Captain,
mm-hmm,
which everybody should read. They're absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Kathleen. What I do mention in the book is that 9/11 was significant for me in coming to write this book, although I didn't realize that until later. I've been teaching the Civil War for about almost 25 years, and I always had something to say about Lincoln's assassination, but it wasn't until after 9/11 had happened that I came to this topic, although really quite a bit later. And I was in New York the day that this happened. September 11th was the first day of the fall semester at New York University, and as I was leaving my apartment and walking to class, the second plane hit the tower. So what moved me as a scholar of the Civil War was to understand how people responded to this absolutely catastrophic event on a human scale, on the scale of everyday life. What I saw around me, as it felt like everybody was in shock and the whole world was grieving, but in fact it was quite a bit more complex and complicated than that.
Yes, it was. Let's go to, I got to read Whitman tonight. Let's go to the opposite response to this and to Rodney for a moment. You write that, because I get so involved in this. I mean, I just could cry now. And I cried when I went to Ford's Theater. I'd been there for the first time. I just started weeping. Or when I went to the Lincoln Memorial, the same. I just got overwhelmed by the enormity of this man. So it's hard for me to understand somebody like Rodney, who wrote in his diary about the Yankee aggression, seeing all of this as Yankee aggression, unlawfully interfering with the natural and constitutional rights of white Southerners.
You know, your responses are very interesting to me, Kathleen. I've often had similar responses. When I go to the Lincoln Memorial or Ford's Theater, and the sense that this happened right here, and it was such a momentous event, I think it's also important, as not just as historians and scholars, but as citizens, that we also understand, which isn't the same as condoning or agreeing
right.
with, but at least understand other people's responses. And Rodney Dorman's responses, we need to understand that they came from a very, very deep pro-slavery, racist, in his case certainly very explicitly racist, frame of mind. And again, that has nothing to do with condoning what he's saying, but to get into the head of somebody like that, for whom Lincoln was a monster and a tyrant,
yes.
and was absolutely destroying the world that this man was part of, and from this, from which this man derived his power and status in the world.
Mm-hmm. It is hard to understand that, though, isn't it? It's just...
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I should say that reading Rodney Dorman's diary, although sometimes it was amusing because he was funny and he would say things that were actually kind of clever about the people he hated, his turns of phrases, and yet it was also painful to read that diary because the hatred in his case was so deep.
Right. Rich, thank you so much for your call. Donna is next in Fall Creek. Hi, Donna.
Hi. We came across the diary of a relative from Sugar Grove, Illinois, and she just had a simple comment in there that President Lincoln died today, not assassinated, just died.
And that is it.
That was it.
That
Nothing
was it.
More about it.
Huh.
So
you know,
and I thought, really? But then at the same time, they had a 9-year-old son who had gotten an arm caught in an apple press. I guess it's not pressing apples, probably playing with it, and had to have his arm amputated below the elbow. And that simple statement was in there, too. Robbie had his arm amputated below the elbow today because
he got caught
in the apple press.
Oh, my
End
gosh.
End of story. Nothing in future days about recovery or anything. So I think they're just people who state the facts, and that's it.
That is such an interesting comment, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because of course I came across many, many entries just like that, and it took me a while to figure out what was going on. And part of what was going on, according to what I could tell, people were really busy. I mean, women worked really hard in the 19th century, and they didn't have a lot of time to write in their diaries and journals. And yet, the fact that people even made time to write down those sentences just to keep a record of it, because they knew they were participating in history. They knew something momentous had happened. Not everybody had time to describe their shock and their sorrow and their grief, but they had to make a record of it. I have a wonderful diary from a farmer in Massachusetts where every day he would just write something like, planted corn today. And the only difference in years of this diary comes on April 15th, where he writes, President Lincoln assassinated. That's it, just like the caller was saying. No emotion. The fact that he wrote that instead of what he had planted that day indicates how momentous that was for
mm-hmm.
him.
Thank you so much. And this email comes from Holly from Spring Green, who says, thanks for the program. Can't wait to read your book. Our family has a collection of letters from our Civil War soldiers, three brothers from McHenry, Illinois. And this touching writing of the time, the handwritten page was with the letters. At first, the news, we were jubilant and happy. From every source, victory came, some resulting in gladdening hearts which had long been oppressed. We began to breathe free again, feeling that the dreadful scourge of war was at last to pass from our land and our remaining to return triumphantly to their dear homes. Our flags waved more joyously than ever before. In a word, the war was ended, and peace and justice were again to resume their sway over our nation, our now free America. And then the next entry, but oh, the saddening news that comes trembling across the wires that our president has been foully assassinated. Oh, heavens, can this be true? The great, the noble-minded, the good president murdered. It's too terrible to think of, and we find ourselves hoping that this may be one of the many telegraph errors which have been so prevalent. And it goes on and on. Obviously, very deep emotion that's right on out there.
And a wonderful, wonderful entry there, a wonderful historical document. And I would urge all your listeners who have such documents to keep them and preserve them and eventually maybe donate them to a historical society or a library. But what's so wonderful about the one that Holly shared is that it captures the joy of victory and also the expectations of victory. I was so fascinated that the people who wrote that entry thought that peace and justice were going to follow the Civil War and the nation was now free. And, of course, the battlefield war was over, but the war off the battlefield was far from over. And, of course, Reconstruction was simultaneous with the founding of the Ku Klux Klan. And Frederick Douglass knew that without real peace, there wouldn't be any justice. He made that statement. He said there won't be any permanent peace until African Americans have their rights. And then the rest of the entry captures beautifully the disbelief, too terrible to believe. It must have been a mistake. Can this be true? I found those sentiments echoed over and over again, and this was a particularly eloquent one.
Well, I was wondering how people were dealing. I mean, the war had just ended, for heaven's sake. You had to have a lot of people, African Americans, who had left plantations. Where were they going? Where were the Confederate soldiers going? What about the prisons? Were they emptied? There must have been a whole lot of people without any place to go, even.
Yes, so that's a really important point, because while everything is happening around the assassination, there's all of the chaos of the post-war moment. There are many, many African Americans who have left their masters. And in fact, if you read through Confederate diaries at the end of the war, right around the time of the assassination, you see plantation mistresses saying things like, another slave has left. You know, so that is, you know, people are moving about the countryside. Confederates are making their way home. They're in deep despair. The prisons are still full. The men haven't all been mustered out. They're still in camp. They're still in their regiments. Some of them will stay through a good part of the summer. So it's a really in-between moment. The war is over, but not quite over in a technical sense. And then, of course, the War of Hearts and Minds is far, far from over.
Yeah. And we know this story, but remind us of the story before we talk about what happened in the days after. John Wilkes Booth, on April 11th, 1865, heard that speech that Lincoln gave about how Reconstruction would be fraught with difficulty, didn't he?
Yes. So John Wilkes Booth was in the audience that night, as you said at the outset of the program, and it was exactly at the point where Lincoln made his statement about my preference is for black men, certain black men to have the vote. Now, even though that was very irritating to abolitionists like Sarah Brown, who wanted him to cut down the whole tree instead of lopping off the branches, for someone like John Wilkes Booth, it was infuriating. It enraged him and it emboldened him to go forward with the assassination. And according to testimony taken later, the companion standing next to him that night, who was one of the conspirators, heard him say, that is the last speech he will ever make. Now, by God, I'll put him through. And that was in direct reference to the point about black suffrage, because John Wilkes Booth said that means Negro suffrage. Although that means Negro citizenship, only he didn't say Negro. He used a different word that was that was a nasty word. So we know exactly what John Wilkes Booth was thinking, and he was responding specifically to Lincoln's point about voting rights for black men.
We welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour, Martha Hodes. Martha is the author of the highly recommended, by me at least and others as well, Mourning Lincoln. Martha is a professor of history at New York University. She has taught, as you heard her say, the Civil War for over 20 years, and she is the author of two previous prize-winning books, The Sea Captain's Wife, A True Story of Love, Race, and War in the 19th Century, and White Women, Black Men, Illicit Sex in the 19th Century. century South. On this day, an important day in history, the day 150 years ago at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., the 16th president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, was shot at Ford's Theater, and he died April 15th at 7:22 in the morning. What our guest has done, which makes the book so moving, is gathered the thoughts, the written thoughts of everyday people, men, women, African-Americans, Confederates, Unionists, religious people. Oh, it's interesting, too, is how people with the Confederacy frame this as a religious issue, and that is the assassination, and also Unionists did as well. So how do you get God to justify an assassination or justify what's going to happen after the assassination? It's interesting, the rhetoric that was heard in churches all over the country. Well, and we welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, more of them for Martha, and let's go to Joe in Fond du Lac. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Two small questions. Was John Wilkes Booth mourned in some sections of the South after he was captured and shot? And the other question is, what's the whole truth behind that Dr. Mudd that treated Wilkes's leg? I'll kind of hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Sorry, the first question was about, what was it about capturing and shooting Booth? I didn't get the question.
About John Wilkes Booth, were there people who were happy about what happened to him?
Uh-huh, yes. So that's a wonderful question. And in fact, Lincoln's mourners were very upset that he had been shot and killed. He had been tracked down by a Union regiment of cavalry, and they had come across him in a barn in Virginia, and he did not immediately surrender. And one of the soldiers took it upon himself to shoot and kill Booth, which was not the plan of any of his superiors. So people were quite upset that John Wilkes Booth would not be brought to trial, that he would not be punished, and that there was a possibility he might be understood to be a martyr because he had died. So people wanted Booth to be alive. They wanted to see him be tried before a jury, and they wanted to see him suffer. And in their diaries, Union soldiers would often write about the things they personally wanted to do to Booth, and they're often quite gruesome. The question about Dr. Mudd is a little bit beyond the scope of my book. Dr. Samuel Mudd was, of course, the doctor who treated John Wilkes Booth's broken ankle bone because Booth had leapt from the Lincoln box onto the stage and broken a bone. And then as part of during his escape on horseback, he stopped at the house of Dr. Samuel Mudd, who set the bone. And the question was whether Mudd was part of the conspiracy. And Mudd was considered to be part of the conspiracy, and he was brought to trial, and he was given life in prison. But whether or not he was part of the trial or not is an open question for some people, but not so much for scholars.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of how people in the South responded to John Wilkes Booth, was he thought of as a hero? Were they rooting for him? Did they applaud him?
Yeah, that's also a great question, because on the one hand, they did think of him as a hero, and they wrote things in their journals like "Bully for Booth," and "We will welcome him to the South, he always has a home here." But Confederates also had another concern. They did not want Booth to be associated with the White South in general and with Confederate leaders. So even though they applauded him, they also made sure to say things like he was a lone madman, he was acting by himself. They did not want people to think there was a larger conspiracy connected to Confederate leaders, and they were very worried that would be the case. So they both cheered him on, but were sure to cast him as a crazy, one person called him a crazy play actor.
Hmm. And in terms of the amount of interest in the North and in the South in the trials of the conspirators, was there heavy-duty interest? Was it all over the papers? Were the courtrooms jam-packed?
Yes, there was tremendous interest in the trials. So people who couldn't be in Washington followed it very closely in the newspapers, and I know they did that because they would often write out every day what had happened in the courtroom that they had read in the reports. And then in Washington, the courtroom was quite crowded. People were very eager to see the conspirators brought to justice. People with Confederate sympathies were eager to see that justice was served in a different way. They did not, for example, think that the lone woman who was part of the group, Mary Surratt, should be found guilty, and she ended up being the first woman executed by the federal government in American history. So there was quite a bit of contention and quite a bit of interest and concern, and people were quite consumed with the trial.
Mm-hmm. All of the pictures that you see, and you make reference to this very early on, that we started seeing the black mourning almost hours after the news of his death, didn't we?
Yes. What's so interesting is people write in their letters and journals, instantly my village or town was transformed, draped in black bunting. But of course, it wasn't instantaneous. It took the energy and the muscle of workers who had to climb up on ladders and tack up the black cloth, and women who had to sew borders, black borders, onto flags and hang them outside. So people actually worked very hard to transform these towns into a picture of mourning, but they did it so quickly after the news came and so instantly that it seemed kind of like an instantaneous transformation.
Mm-hmm. And what about the train? Where all did it go, Martha? You also write about, was it different companies that owned different train tracks? So there was something about that made
it... That's exactly right. So Lincoln's funeral was in Washington on April 19th, and then his body was taken on a homeward journey that took 2 weeks and covered 1,700 miles. The funeral train made 11 major stops after Washington, Baltimore, Harrisburg, Philadelphia, then New York City, Albany, Buffalo, Cleveland, Columbus, Indianapolis, Chicago, and finally Springfield, his hometown, where he was buried on May 4th. But you're absolutely right. There was no single funeral train because railroad gauges were all run by different companies, and they were different sizes in 1865. So no single train could run the whole length from Washington to Springfield, which meant there were many different funeral trains, and people got on and off the train. Dignitaries from each state would get on and off as the train passed through their state. Of course, Lincoln's body traveled the entire way, and there was a corps of veterans who removed his body for each funeral celebration and put it back. And it wasn't just those 11 major cities that mattered. Everywhere the train passed, people came down to the station to see it. It could be the middle of the night, raining, 3 o'clock in the morning, muddy. They would come down, build bonfires, pay tribute, hold their children up, take off their hats, kneel down in prayer. It was really quite an amazing ritual.
And it took some time, right?
Yes, that took 2 weeks.
Goodness.
For all of that to happen. That's quite right.
And where was Mary?
Well, that's also a wonderful question. Mary Lincoln, who had been terribly, terribly traumatized by seeing her husband shot in front of her eyes, she was not part of any of the funeral ceremonies. She retired to the White House to a separate bedroom, not her previous bedroom. She couldn't bear to be anywhere near where she had been with her husband. She did not attend the services on April 19th. She did not attend any part of the funeral train, and she did not attend the funeral in Springfield. She was so devastated. She only let a very small number of friends, women friends, come and see her and talk to her. And over again in personal writings, people wrote, "Poor Mrs. Lincoln." I found that phrase so many times by men, by women. People just were trying to understand how devastating this must have been for her.
Mm-hmm. How did the world respond? In what ways did they respond? And did it vary significantly from country to country?
Well, what's so interesting about the world's response is that in the world of public condolences, there was an enormous outpouring of public condolences. So from every country around the entire world, many, many organizations, churches, working men's organizations, women's sewing circles, anything you can imagine, people sent official expressions of condolence, not only to the federal government in Washington, by the way, but also to Mary Todd Lincoln personally. So there was a separate archive of letters to her. But, of course, the official condolences don't always capture the range of responses. So I read the diary and private correspondence of a man named Charles Francis Adams, who was the U.S. minister to London. And, of course, London sent official diplomatic statements expressing their condolences. But in his diary, Charles Francis Adams made note of the many Confederate sympathizers he came across in London, how they were worried about poor Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, how people sent him anti-Lincoln doggerel poems about Lincoln going to hell and being the devil. So again, you don't always get the personal responses by reading the public communication.
Absolutely. And what about from the pulpit? God was obviously on the Confederate side and God was on the Union side. So how did the how was the assassination of President Lincoln handled in the pulpit?
That's also what was very interesting to me. Of course, the victors were sure that God had orchestrated Union victory. And then that was one of the reasons they just could not fathom why God had taken Lincoln away at the moment of victory. And that was the big question for their ministers, why? Now, in the Confederacy, it was the opposite. Confederates were devastated, unable to understand why God had let the Confederacy lose the Civil War. Then when Lincoln is assassinated, they see that as God making some kind of statement. They still can't figure out why they lost the war, but they are sure that God is trying to at least put the arrogant victors in their places. And ministers, you know, ministers struggle too. They had prepared Easter Sunday sermons, and now they had to go back and incorporate this terrible event, and it was hard for them to answer the why question also.
What about black soldiers? I know that you write about the soldiers of the 54th Mass. The news was overwhelming. How do we have their reminiscences here? And also, many men of the 25th U.S. Colored Troops who refused to believe the report until confirmed. What was their grieving like, and what happened to those men?
Well, what's so interesting, you know, there weren't a lot of literate African Americans in the 19th century, but there were some, and there were black soldiers who did write letters and keep diaries, and there were also black soldiers who wrote letters to black newspapers, and that was a wonderful source. There were also, in the Civil War, black men largely could not be officers, and so the officers of black troops were white men. And those men would sometimes, the white men would write letters describing what their soldiers, how they were reacting to the assassination. So the black soldiers were utterly devastated. One man who was quite literate and wrote beautiful letters called it a loss irreparable. They, like all African Americans at the time, and they had a special stake because they had fought in the war and they had lost comrades and friends, but they also worried deeply about Lincoln's successor. They were very clear that they had been fighting for freedom, and with the war over, not just freedom, but also equality and citizenship and suffrage rights. And they trusted Lincoln by the end of the war. They trusted Lincoln deeply, and they knew that Andrew Johnson was not the same kind of man and politician, and they were very, very trepidatious about what was going to happen at the end of the war when they would go back home. And it depends, of course, if they had come from the North or the South. Black soldiers came from both. But it was a time of great uncertainty for those men.
Mm-hmm. What's it like for you to have been so immersed in all these people's lives? I was telling my producers today that I was coming on the air very much in 1865. I've been in 1865 for days now, reading your book and thinking about Lincoln. And you must really be. It was just such a time, and to be a historian of that time, you must be pretty deeply immersed.
Absolutely right, Kathleen. So the immersion is one of the things that makes it easier to write the book. So, you know, of course, I was in archives, in libraries. You know, some of it is digitized, but I was also looking at many, many hundreds of these original letters, opening original diaries, turning their pages. And, you know, there is a certain locution of 19th century ways of expressing things. And I would find myself sometimes thinking in those ways or even speaking in those ways.
Oh.
And I would, you know, I'd get up from my desk with my head just, in a way, spinning and just, you know, deeply part of all of the emotions people had expressed, all of the tension between Union and Confederate. It was very, very all-pervasive. And it really... It helps a writer write because you're so deeply in that world when you have all those words around you, the words that people at the time wrote.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you ever so much for being with us on this day particularly. Will you do anything that will mark this day or tomorrow other than probably doing tens of thousands of interviews?
Well, I am doing many interviews, but this evening I'll be at Ford's Theater.
Oh, you will?
To Lincoln, yes. And I will also be on a panel on the stage at Ford's Theater tomorrow with a number of other scholars talking about mourning for Lincoln and the loss of American leaders.
Will that be taped, do you know at all, Martha?
I'm sure that I do believe it will be on C-SPAN.
Sure
it will. But if you look up Ford's Theater,
okay.
Online, I think your listeners can find information about it there. And Ford's Theater is a wonderful place, by the way, which is, of course, about the assassination, but it's also about the legacy of Lincoln, the living legacy.
Right.
And that's what's so wonderful about Ford.
Oh, it's quite a spot to go to. I'll have to check C-SPAN. And Martha, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Martha Hodes, the book is Mourning Lincoln. And it is well worth your time. It's very, very well done. Martha is a professor of history at New York University, and we thank her for being with us. On this day, 150 years ago, President Abraham Lincoln shot at Ford's Theater at 10:15 in the evening, and he died the following day at 7:22. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to K.P. as well for on-air production. Thanks to Scotty Myers for helping us, and thanks to you for listening.